session number 18463, Reel 5.
Reel 5.
Okay. Anyway, we set off at well after dark, and I'd guess about 10 o'clock, something like that, and arrived at the end as far as the, nearly as far as the road would go. There was a bridge, blown bridge, a little bit farther on, and we were, well, I'll be honest, it was all a complete mystery to all of us. We didn't really know what we were doing. In fact, our platoon of 30-odd people was taken over from a 200-strong American company, but we didn't know that at the time. And I was set off on this little mound, and whilst the section commanders went off and, you know, found the positions and what have you, and these Americans came along, I think about 50 or 60 of them, and they said, "Where are the rest of you guys then?" We said, "Well, we are the rest of them. There aren't any more. There's just us." And every one of them, because every one of them had a semi-automatic rifle and M1, and they all seemed to be armed with machine guns and goodness knows what. Everyone seemed to have an automatic weapon. And they cleared off and left us. And then Gus laid out the section positions. Couldn't see anything because it's pitch dark, but there was a dreadful smell everywhere. It was obviously corruption all around the place, and we spent a fairly concerned night in these dug in and spent a fairly worrying night. Our first night in the line, you know, there was occasional shells and mortars, and we could see fires over in the other side of the place there, but it was the smell that was pretty grim. And we had a little American sandbagged OP, and my LMG group was ordered to occupy this, and that would be the left-hand flank of the platoon. And when morning came, of course, it was obvious that this was like a sore thumb sticking up there, these yellow sandbags, you know, sticking up on this little pimple. And unfortunately, Gus had, in the dark, had laid out the sections, 1, 2, 3 up the slope, so each section's fired into the back of the people ahead of it, so there had to be a fair bit of alteration before they had to dig in daylight, which was a bit unwise. And we manned this OP all day, about on a 24-hour basis, and it was manned by three people all the time. But the unfortunate thing was the North Koreans were using tanks to shoot at this OP, and they mainly fired AP, solid shot, which didn't explode, but it was chalky ground, and as you laid in the bottom of this thing, as they fired at you, as the shot went into the ground, it shook up through the ground. You know, it was quite an unpleasant experience. And of course, by daylight, we'd realised that this hill, incidentally, we now name Boot Hill, because it was covered in lightly buried dead bodies and bits of bodies and helmets with heads in and all things like that. Most unpleasant area. But we moved the sections back during the day, and at the back there were American 4-2 mortar emplacements, sandbags emplacements, and we used them to sleep and rest in during the day, and only manned this forward post, you know, which was looking out over the bridge and, of course, the paddy and what have you there. And everybody else was ready just to nip back up over the ridge should the need be. We dug a toilet, I remember. As you know, first thing you always do, of course, you know, is dig the toilet. You dig a hole for the lumps and another hole full of stones for the urinal nearby. And next to that was a foot sticking up through the paddy there where one had been buried, and his foot had come up with the old gook boot on. And I tried to cover it up, you know, and things like that, but it couldn't happen. And eventually I tried to get a shovel and hack it off, but I wasn't brave enough to do it. And in the end I built a little mound over it, and every time it rained it washed it away. They just behind their toilet, the Americans had buried misfires, 4-2 mortar misfires. So we it was quite an interesting little place. And then just over a little stream, on the back of that, was the Argyle mortar line, because we were down with the Argyles. The battalion was a mile and a half away. And our platoon alone was down with the Argyles. Now, Farrah Hockley, I'm afraid, puts that as a company. Some of our people put it as a company. But there is no doubt whatsoever, it was just our platoon down there on its own, detached from the rest of the people. The road was unusable during the day. In fact, there was a destroyed brigade lorry just below us. And any movement on it, they fired on. In fact, any movement on our position, they fired upon. Because I was walking across back from the OP one day, and I thought, oh, Russian helmet, Russian-style helmet. Have a look at that. Picked it up. And unfortunately, there was a three-quarters of a head inside, you see, and I tossed it down. And because I'd stopped, they'd had time to have a little think about me, and they started firing, not particularly at me, but they started firing at us, and also HE at the Argyles. And we saw this, they had some carriages up on the top there, and this sergeant started to go up with a first aid, two of them started to go up with a first aid bag. We could see the Red Cross on the bag, where we knew where he was going, and two of them were going up there. First one got hit. And then the sergeant got hit and tumbled back down again. I'd like to think they were both wounded, you know. But they never got to the top with their medical stuff till it was all over. That was a very unpleasant place. We were there 4 days. On the fourth day, the brigade commander came down with a CO. Typical of all COs and things, they had their map cases and things. And they walked out of the very place where I'd been standing when the North Koreans took umbrage and started firing at us. And it is said, and I cannot vouch for this, but they said that they planted a solid shot at the foot of the CO and the brigade commander. All I can say is they did scurry back over the top. And that night we were moved, because it was a very unpleasant place. The stench was unbelievably dreadful. And the paddy below, apparently, it was full of dead bodies. And there was a little, just below our position, they set a night standing patrol down there. And apparently the Americans had dressed bodies in American uniforms and then mined them so that, you know, as soon as the Koreans came along, they'd try and lift off the uniforms and get killed. That might not be true. It might have been that a party of Koreans had come in dressed in American uniforms, which seems a little bit more likely, you know. But that gave a little bit of a fright to the standing patrol. But as I say, we were only there 4 days, and we got the word to that we were going back that night. And what they did was, the corporals, section commanders, went back over the top there, because we had to load up our kit. A 1,500 weight came down, 1,500 weight truck came down, and all the gear that we had, you know, food, rations, ammunition, and all that stuff, was loaded on there. And we had to wait on the forward slope to cover all this, you know, whilst they were loading up. And they literally, nobody told us. We knew we were going back, but we didn't have any real information. And we were lying in these pits, and we've been told to get these helmets with these bits of head and what have you in, and put them on the parapets of the trenches and the sandbags, line them up on there to make it look in mourning as if there was still somebody there, you know. And we'd done that, and the trench was terrible. And the hour went by, and something ran down in front of us. And my friend Bill Everett said, "That's North Koreans." Now, if he'd have said gooks, I'd have been all right. But he said North Koreans, and it sounded so frightening that we panicked a bit. To cut a very long story short, we had a very frightening half an hour where we decided that it was probably an animal or something like that, you know. And shortly after that, I said to him, "Look, you better nip back and find out what the hell's going on, because it's all gone quiet now, and we thought we'd probably been left, you see." And just about at that moment, my friend Ken Partridge came up on the reverse slope and called over and said, "Come back now." And we all went down, assembled, and formed up as a platoon, you know, marching like each side of the road and all that, three yards intervals. And we were told to be very quiet because the expectation was that a small, well, bridge we called it, but it was a culvert really, it was expected that there would be a patrol waiting for us there that might sort of shoot us up. And the old lorry was in the middle, the 1500, with its engine very, very low, no lights or anything like that. And we walked down this road, came to the culvert, nothing happened. And we came back to the main B Company position where we, being last in, we dug in on a little mound, which tree-covered mound. Those of us on the lower slopes were okay. We dug in this sort of soft loam. On the top bit, it was rocky, and they had to sort of build up a little bit. And that's where we spent the remainder of our time on the Nactong. And each morning and evening, there was shell fire, both friendly and otherwise. And the American shells, it's quite an interesting thing about the American shells. They'd fire them at about six at a time, I guess, salvo going over. And just above us, there'd be explosions in the sky. And the story given us was that this was some sort of booster that drove the shell farther on into enemy territory, and we could hear a few explosions. I later found there was nothing of the sort. It was 40 fuses. At the end of the Second World War, they were building the fuses of an inferior material, and because they fired them so quickly, it didn't matter. They only had to last, you know, a few weeks or months or what have you. But these have been in store, and they're only supposed to be for training purposes. And as they were close proximity fuses, and if the shell got too close, it exploded. So only about 50% of them ever arrived at the other end. And the North Koreans fired a few back at us, you know, things like that. Not as many. But we could see the mortars, of course, came in and went all around. And we had an OP. We took an OP over. My friend at Canterbury was actually in the OP before us, and we took over from him. And that looked out all over the Nactong. Fantastic place it was. And we would go up there. Ken Partridge went the first day. I went the second, and then the other sections took it in turn. So you'd have one, two, three, four, five, six. It'd be every 6 days you were up in the OP. And he went up there for 24 hours. And you had this fantastic view over the Nactong River. And the second time I went up there, Ken said to me that the MMGs had been up there that night. And I said to him, what's that? There was a sacking screen, you know, up there just behind our post. He said, I don't know. He said, they banged that in last night. I don't know why that is. Anyway, the reason for it was, of course, they were going to fire the night I was there. They were going to fire through this sacking screen, which stops the flash, whatever, from the other side. And they came up there and did their firing. They were trying to get return fire. There was a question. Patrols were going out, and they couldn't find the enemy. You know, had they withdrawn? And they fired this sacking screen just over our heads. You know? Oh, the FFO was up there as well, the American FFO, and then cleared off. Never spoke to us. Never said a word. Came up, guns out, fired their belt and a half or whatever, and cleared off. Sorry. And the following day, it might have been the day after that, I can't really remember, we came back down, and the mail had just arrived, and we were all reading our mail up in the, leaning up against the trees there, and MMGs came again, up on the hill there, laid their guns out, two guns out, section of guns there, gunners up behind it, started fire there. Halfway through the first belt, and these mortar bombs dropped straight on them, and we watched them run for cover. Didn't hit them. Fortunately, didn't hit them. I don't know why. But the funny thing was, nobody took any notice. They were so busy with their mail, they looked up and said, oh, I'm injured. And went on reading their mail. Because unfortunately, the mosquitoes were dreadful down there. I mean, they must have been as big as bats, I should think. Nothing you could do. And we weren't having anti-malaria pills. I think we had one. The Americans apparently only had one a week or something. We had one. But we hadn't taken any with us, presumably, and we didn't have any. And that was going to pay later on. But the trenches were filling up with water right up to the top. and we had to bail them out each morning. And I suddenly realised one day, I went round the front and I suddenly realised that where we were bailing them out, there were gullies. And you could just look, you could see exactly where every trench was. So if they had come up to us, you know, they'd have known exactly where we were. We thought we were well hidden in the trees. But these lines of water, where they'd worn the little gullies in the ground, actually pointed straight to us. So we said, well, we better not do that anymore. And the trenches filled up with water. And we used to sit on the stand in the morning. We'd sit on the back edge with our feet on the forward edge, you know, rather than get in the trenches. We were supposed to get in the trenches, but we didn't, because it was up to the waist. And one morning we were sitting there, and the shells came over every morning, you know, but these came over a little bit closer than usual, and all you could hear was pop, 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 as everybody leapt in the water. It was quite an experience, I think, really. At that time, the patrols were pretty frightening as well, because the tanks, there were some tanks used to go out during the day. They only went out at day and came back at night, whilst the standing patrols went out in the evening and stayed all night. But the tank, they'd run some wires out there, and of course the tanks tore them up all the time, so the line was never working. And it was a corporal's job to go out on these patrols, always a corporal's job. And one of them, he didn't want to go at all. And I got so annoyed, because I'd never been out there. And he said to the platoon commander, well, Corporal Barrett's been out there, send him out there. And of course I got a bit annoyed. I lost my temper actually with him, and said I'd never been out there. I hadn't got the faintest idea where it was. I just hadn't got. I'd been going the other way. I'd been going to the big OP up on the high OP, rather, you know, which overlooked thing. I'd never been out on this other one, and I got very annoyed about that. And I must say, the platoon commander took my part, and I didn't have to go. But it wasn't the going. It was just that this guy was backing out of it. He was a full corporal, regular full corporal, and he was saying, oh, you know, let one of these junior National Service Corporal go. It wasn't a very pleasant place to go. I mean, one of the chaps had a nervous breakdown because he, not one of ours, another company, because he went to step over what he thought was a log and put his foot on this. It wasn't a log, it was somebody's chest, you know, and went straight through. So it wasn't a pleasant place to be. And there were lots of mines out there. And the gooks had got into the minefields before us, about 2 weeks before we arrived. And they were full up with dead, you know, where they'd died in the minefields down there. But, you know, we had a fairly quiet indoctrination, isn't it, with war, I think, you know. And I think we perhaps thought that we were, after a fortnight, by about the 19th, when we began to move, I got a feeling we thought we were veterans, you know. We weren't. Well, I think we thought we were pretty good guys, you know. But the fighting elsewhere, what had actually happened was, we'd been put down this area, in this bulge in the Nakton, below Taegu, and the expectation was the 10th, what's known as the 10th North Korean Mechanized Division, was expected to cross the river, which they'd already tried once and got knocked out by the Americans, and fight their way up. But for some reason, and I don't really know why, they never did a major attack. They virtually surrounded us on, what, three sides, and there was patrol activity, but they never actually attacked. And I think their commander was perhaps not as adventuresome as some, you know. Then on the, I forget the date, I guess about 17th or 18th, they started to put patrols across the river. We started patrols across the river, the Middlesex. And the IO went first of all, Bucknell, with a friend of mine. And he couldn't find anybody. He didn't go far enough to find anybody, as it turned out. Unfortunately, he was under a lot of stress. His batman, who he was rather friendly with, had died in a jeep accident, and I think he held himself responsible. Least said about that, the better. And my friend in D Company, whose story I wrote, Paddy Birmingham, and his platoon, they put a firm base over of another platoon, and they went up to the firm base and then went over to scour the hills. And his is quite an interesting story. I mean, it's well worth reading. But basically, they found the North Koreans and were very lucky to escape. They only had a couple of guys wounded, of which one was the American FFO's signaller. Unfortunately, his friend abandoned him, and Paddy had to bring him in. But anyway, at that moment of time, we had orders to pull out. First of all, we had an order to pull out, and obviously the brigadier said, well, who's going to relieve us? There wasn't anybody, and we didn't go that day. And I think it was the next day that we went, would be the 20th, when we were told to be ready to move. It's funny enough, it had gone very quiet. There wasn't the morning shelling or the evening shelling, so it all seemed a bit different. And to our horror, the American relieving troops drove it into their lorries and drove up to our slit trenches and tossed their bedding rolls and things on the edge there. And we're thinking, oh, any minute now they're going to, you know, be fired at. But they weren't. I presume the North Koreans had withdrawn. I mean, I can't think they knew it. We then went off to a concentration area on the edge of the Nakdong, right up on some hills where we could look down on the Nakdong. And then there was a sort of a plain and some very high hills in the background, a little bit shelling, but the village down the bottom there, where the American battalion was holding the river crossing point, which was virtually destroyed, was shelled at regular intervals. It was a bit like, I can only describe, I imagine the Great War, where salvos of shells came in and the trees, you know, fell about and leaves flew up all over the place. And we had a wash up here, incidentally. There was a nice little stream there, so we had a bit of a brew up and washed our feet and things like that in the stream, and had a little bit of a bath. And I guess about in the afternoon, before 4 o'clock, but 3 o'clock or something like that, we started to march down this winding open slope down toward this village. And we were lucky, actually, because the salvo hit as we were marching down, but we managed to get through, our company managed to get through the village, and the next salvo didn't land till we out on it. It was like a beach, in actual fact. I guess it was about 50 yards wide or something like that to where the footbridge was. And we got caught there, and the shells literally dropped in amongst us. And I don't know if we had any. The Americans had some casualties. The American tank crew, they were sitting out on the front of their tank watching us go. And two of them certainly got wounded. We may have had a couple wounded, I don't really know. But it's all sort of concentrating the mind now, and you're within yourself. You can't really worry about anybody else. You know, you've got to worry about other people because you've got people really you're responsible for. But in a sense, you've gone back into your head, sort of thing, you see. And we crossed over this. It had been a little concrete bridge. I should think it had been something that had been blown up, and somebody, probably the North Koreans, had built a sort of a rickety old footbridge up over it. And we went over that, and there were some tanks on the other side, sort of protecting the area. And then we marched, I guess it was a mile and a half down this road, and we were warned not to pick anything up because it might be booby-trapped and what have you. And I passed a beautiful set of pliers and a leather case, and I didn't pick them up. And the chap behind me bent down and scooped them up, and I wasn't half annoyed. But we marched on for about a mile and a half, I guess, mile and a half, and the shelling stopped. And we got to this sort of little dip in the road, and there was a little hamlet. You could see this little hamlet there. And the American Reconnaissance Company, who were holding that area and who had been attacked during the night and what have you, were on this little hillock and in the hamlet. We got to within about 200 yards of them, I guess. And the shells started coming over, and we'd been told not to stop. So we didn't stop. We kept marching on, And suddenly, and I got a feeling it might have been John Shifter. It just sounded like him. It was somebody in authority shouted out, "Get down, get down!" And we fell into the ditches on the side of the road. And this salvo landed. And most of it burst in the trees, in actual fact. And the leading section, who was a chap named Corporal Brown, Topper Brown, a shell burst in the tree right above him and smothered him in bits, you know, bits of shrapnel. And he was just black. Him and the guy next to him, who was also wounded. I think it only wounded the two of them. And I'm not even sure whether one of them was just shot. But they were as if they were like in soot, black soot, and blood oozing from little wounds all over them. It was rather strange, because Topper Brown had been, during the war, he'd been in the civil defence, and he'd been smothered with glass. All the time we were in Hong Kong, regular intervals, he'd go off to the MO and he'd extract a little bit of glass from it. Now he's got a load with little bits of shrapnel. So he didn't have a very lucky war in either the Second or the Korean War. And we then marched on into the village. And it was getting dark. It was dark by now. And my 6th platoon, there's this little mound with these Americans on. We were a little bit jumpy, I might tell you. And we dug in on the forward slope, and we could see this dark mass of this big hill, which would have, Hill 325, I think it was, which would eventually be called Middlesex Hill, ahead of us. We had a quiet night. I mean, the previous night, the Gooks had crept down the drainage ditch and tried to attack the tanks, and they'd killed a number of them in the drainage ditch there. And the following morning, in fact, they were showing us the what we call Burt guns, these ones with a real magazine, a Russian one, and they were showing us that they were marked 1950, because at that time the Russians were saying they hadn't given any guns to North Korea before that time, you know, since 1949. Here we had 1950 stamped all over them. And they were occasional cracks up on the hill. We could see the shells going up on the hill the following morning on 325. And number 4 platoon, Chris Lawrence, we saw them marching off down the road. I mean, we didn't really know what they were doing. In fact, they were going to attack Plum Pudding Hill. And we were understood that the other two companies, A and D, over the other side, were going to attack Middlesex Hill from the other side. And my guess is that the CO decided to make a diversionary attack at this end of the hill on this little hill, Plum Pudding. And the expectation was they wouldn't carry it. I don't think they, I mean, Chris Lawrence said to me a couple of years ago, we were never expected to take that. And whilst a D and A company in that order went up the other slope and attacked the hill from that way. Massive great hill feature it was. Anyway, of course, contrary to all expectations, Chris and his platoon captured the hill. I had a few casualties, and we saw the casualties coming down. And just at that moment, we were drawn back from our trenches, and everything was now out of view. We couldn't see forward, so we couldn't see what was going on forward, and we laid in a little hollow. And we hadn't been there more than 5 minutes, and a great mass of mortar bombs came down on where we'd been, you know, probably dropped in our trenches for all I know. Poor old Americans up on the forward part of the ridge, and they were jumping out of their trenches and running, because the previous day a mortar bomb had dropped in one of them and hadn't done them a lot of good, you know, messed one of them up just a wee bit. And they've sprung across the road as well, turned a jeep over.